You're listening to episode 15 of the UAV Digest. I'm Max Flight in Hartford, Connecticut.
And I'm David Vanderhoof in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
David, we have kind of a mix of topics, some military, some civil this episode.
Yeah, it's good to be, after the last two episodes of having guests and our discussion about the roadmap, it's nice to be back on track and doing some just good old-fashioned news stories from the week. So we're going to talk about the Dubai Air Show and the UAV market growth in the Middle East. We're going to talk about kind of a fishy subject from now on. We're going to talk about Piaggio's Hammerhead, China sends the UAVs towards Japan, autonomous drones in Peru chasing rainforest, foam drones, a set of UAV crashes, one into a ship and the other into the ocean, and one getting fished out of the sea. So quite a diverse amount of topic. First news item, UAV market in Middle East grows, U.S. may look to draw back. This was from defensenews.com. Driven by border concerns, UAV growth in the Middle East is projected to grow $3.8 billion over the next decade, with that region accounting for 8% of the world market. Clearly, drones are following the way of airliners, considering we had that huge purchase in the Dubai Air Show for Boeing in the 777, huh, Max?
Yeah, absolutely. That region, the Middle East, is just seeing some pretty spectacular growth. As you mentioned, we've seen that in the commercial aviation sector and now also in the unmanned sector. This forecast, it comes from the Thiel Group, which is a highly respected organization. They do some fantastic industry analysis. And that's a lot of growth, almost $4 billion over the next decade. But it's kind of interesting, you know, in the class of vehicles that they're interested in, the U.S. and Israel are kind of primarily the major suppliers in that segment. Now, if you're talking about sales into the Middle East, probably Israel is not going to be high on their list of suppliers.
So that basically leaves the U.S. What the Middle Eastern countries are looking for is ISR, which is intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance, keeping monitoring shipping lanes or area. A2AD, which is anti-access aerial denial, which is being more proactive, and maybe we'll start seeing UAVs in the Middle East carrying things like anti-shipping missiles, because there's always the danger of the trade in the Persian Gulf being blocked by potential adversaries. You can read that as Iran, because basically the rest of the Middle Eastern countries on the other side of the Persian Gulf are kind of fearful of that country. And combat air patrols, which the Middle East has always been up to purchasing the latest and greatest hardware. So having a UAV fly their air defenses is cheaper than having a manned fighter.
Yeah, and I don't know if growth in this area, David, is stabilizing or destabilizing to the region. I'm not sure what the effect of this is.
It's probably, in a warped sort of way, it is kind of stabilizing, because if you follow military UAV news, every other day the Iranian Army or Air Force is announcing another drone that they're putting out in the air. And the other countries in the area want that technology also, and not to be dependent on foreign countries, i.e. the United States. So it's in the Persian Gulf area, it's always, I want what they've got. So I'm sure that with Iran making all sorts of noises about their technology and their drones, it's going to, the smaller countries are going to want the same technology or better. Now, the leader of the world is in UAVs and has been for quite some time is Israel, and that's another country where people go, I want that, but they're not going to, they may quietly buy it, or you'll find out that some of the technology will transfer from one country to another, but via a second or third party. So that'll be interesting to watch to see if some of the Israeli technology, which is state-of-the-art, transfers. And you know the U.S., with our declining military purchases, Northrop Grumman and wants to sell as much technology as they can to Middle Eastern countries who want to buy it. So, and it'll stave off the less purchases in the United States.
Now, there's another topic contained in this article concerning the U.S. Air Force. And there's some interesting comments from a major general who heads the Air Force portion of the Quadrennial Defense Review. That's out of the Pentagon. And he's suggesting that we may need to take a different look, I think, at how we do that ISR, that intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance. And I think he's saying that we need to consider moving away from kind of being everywhere all the time watching with these drones, and instead maybe shift to a different kind of a strategy where we watch for things that are happening and then deploy the missions to take a look at that. I guess that makes sense. It sounds like it's a way to kind of reduce the cost somewhat.
Right. And, you know, if we have reliable intelligence from our Middle Eastern allies, not just Israel, but the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia, and we teach them to use the technology, it's a benefit to us. Back in Desert Storm, we had built the whole infrastructure into Saudi Arabia because they were worried about Iraq attacking Saudi Arabia. And we had built an infrastructure ahead of things. So maybe it's okay for our Middle Eastern allies to start taking up this technology, because should we need to react, we'll have an infrastructure already built in, and we can get reliable intelligence from our allies.
So sticking with military for just a few more moments, the next item is from Defense Industry Daily. And, you know, it was just a matter of time before somebody came up with a headline like this. I think they thought they were creative, but the headline is Male Performance Enhancement. Now, male is M-A-L-E. Piaggio's P-1HH Hammerhead UAV. And we've talked about the Hammerhead previously, I believe, which was based on the business turboprop Piaggio P-180. And they've had a first flight, so I think it's worth mentioning that so that we keep that story going. But this first flight occurred at Italy's Trapani Air Force Base. Good for Piaggio. It seems like the flight was successful.
Yeah, well, let's be honest, Max. We're partial to the Avanti. It seems to be on our other show, it always comes up. And if you ever get a chance to hear an Avanti, you'll know an Avanti. But it's pretty impressive. You've got Italy taking a big jump forward into the male, M-A-L-E, being medium altitude, long endurance technology, where that's, you're talking about Reapers, Predators, Global Hawks. Global Hawk would be high altitude. So, and they're trying to get into the game, and the way they did it was pretty unique. They took a very successful aircraft and they trained it into and made it into a remote control aircraft, or a UAV. So I think we're going to follow this one because, you know, I thought Avantis looked cool, but the Hammerhead with all of the extra stuff on it in battle gray looks even cooler. So I think we'll be following that. Oh, the other thing we should say is they flew it clandestinely on its first flight and didn't make the announcement until they were at the show at Dubai.
That's right.
And we also, and the United Arab Emirates, several companies have highly invested in Piaggio for precisely this. So this is another way of those Gulf Coast countries trying to get UAV technology and trying to get a quality product quickly.
And just really quickly, David, the promotional video of the flight, I thought is fascinating, because when they have views from cameras inside the Hammerhead, and you can see what would be the cockpit area. It's completely devoid of any gauges or any electronics, and all of the avionics and things that the that a pilot, of course, would use is gone. It's just bare metal, and it it kind of makes the point, I think, that, you know, this is something that they're, I think, not just playing with, not just taking a civil aircraft and playing with it, but they're really serious about developing something that's going to be commercially successful.
So I guess we'll jump, we'll move eastward to China unleashes UAVs against Japan. This was from strategypage.com. The Chinese BZK-005 UAV was flown close to Okinawa airspace back in September, and Japan did something it doesn't normally do, and that's launched a bunch of F-15s to go after it. Upon them getting close to intercepting the aircraft, the UAV turned back towards China, but there has been a heightening of tensions between China and Japan over disputed islands. And they're both have now said that, you know, you shooting down my drone flying in your airspace will be considered an act of war, which is sort of surprising because Japan is only supposed to be a defense force and they're usually shy about their military hardware. But clearly it's getting a bit hot in the Pacific, huh, Max?
Yeah. And I wonder about this kind of a situation. If instead the Chinese had sent some fighters, some manned aircraft over towards Japan, I think that would have had different kind of implications. You know, I wonder if sending a drone where in the past you might do nothing or send a manned aircraft is kind of a way to sort of probe the other side without looking as committed as you would if you'd sent a manned aircraft. You know what I mean? It doesn't have the same optics, really, as a manned aircraft. So I don't know if we'll see more things like that, not just in this region, but in others where people take a chance and fly a drone over close to or over the airspace of the other side to see what the reaction is.
Part of the article talks about the fact that Japan is going to get Global Hawks, and they're going to be based in Japan. And the Global Hawks range and optics and sensors basically make it a satellite. And the United States Air Force and will be flying these out of Japan, and they can fly in international airspace and provide excellent reconnaissance capabilities for mainland China and the Chinese islands. We hope that eventually this observations doesn't get brought upon like what we've had in the Persian Gulf, where we've had F-22s come up on Iranian aircraft saying, you can't shoot down my drone because it's in international airspace and you need to go home. Let's not hope that Japan and China get into that where it becomes a little hotter because of UAVs, because people now are realizing that flying a drone, even though the optics isn't the same as flying a manned bomber like the Soviets used to do down the Atlantic, but in the 21st century, it is flying a manned bomber down the Atlantic. It's the same thing. It's an act of passive aggression, I guess you could say.
Yes. And so in that regard, I just wonder if it might be employed more frequently, since that's an option that those with UAVs now have. But I guess we'll see.
I guess we'll continue eastward into Latin America and South America and Peru.
Yes, from phys.org, that's P-H-Y-S .org, we see flying robot will provide a unique view of the world's most biodiverse ecosystem. And what they're talking about is the Peruvian tropical forest. It is so dense that, and there really is so little known about the forest and its interaction with the environment, that scientists have been somewhat hampered from studying it. Now, this is a big forest. According to the article, there are 390 billion trees in this tropical forest. And importantly, it annually absorbs 1.5 billion metric tons of carbon dioxide. So they want to study this because it has such a high importance, really on a global scale. And because of the density of the forest, it just is not easy to get in there. When you fly over it at an altitude, you just can't really see what's going on in the environment. So they have a solution.
Yeah, UAVs. Funny how that works on this show. But this is another one of those really good uses for quadcopters and hexacopters. And actually, they've talked a little bit about what technology is going to be carried. Thermal imaging cameras, as well as visible light cameras, they can fly it through the trees and observe things like monkeys feeding. And we know that some of the drones are quadcopters and hexacopters are quiet, and they can build 3D models, which of course means that once they build the 3D models, they can start running simulations and maybe gather more information. Excellent. I mean, and with using GPS, they can pinpoint exactly where they're studying. So there's a lot of technology, and they're really not sure what they're going to use yet, right, Max?
That's right. I think they're exploring options, but they are looking, as you said, at multi-copters and at fixed-wing aircraft, but for different reasons, but both autonomous, using GPS and compass coordinates and stabilization systems on board.
Yeah, so I think this will be an interesting one to follow, because the technology is going to be interesting, and it's going to open up a portion of the world. It's hard to believe that we still have portions of the world that is unexplored or hard to reach and stuff in this day and age, but we still do. And this sounds like a really good use, and we should follow up with that later.
Yes, it does sound like a really good use, and I think we'll get some really good science out of this as a result.
All right. Well, we'll go back to the Middle East, and we'll go to paramilitary or police. Dubai police introduced a hand-thrown drone at airshow launch. This was from the national.ae, and the autonomous iStart UAS is, and I, this is quote, it sounds like a bad James Bond quote, but it's unfolded, shaken, and thrown into the air with a ground control station to log in details where it was meant to look and land. According to the UK producer, the company would be Blue Bear, and it makes it more easy for operators who do not how to fly drones, huh? So shaken, not stirred, huh, Max?
That's the image it evokes. But I think that's a great way to look at this, because as we look towards use by police and other officials, clearly these won't generally be people that are highly trained in terms of drone operation. So something that can be deployed easily, quickly, and like we say, without a lot of training is something that's going to be attractive to police forces and others like that. This thing is made of foam. It's kind of an interesting vehicle. It's got a 75 centimeter wingspan, so it's a pretty compact a little item. And reportedly, the Dubai police, when shown this little device, did express some interest. So this may be a market that we'll see Blue Bear developing more in the future.
I guess we should keep going. Let's go about my big pet peeve of the week. We've had talked about in the past that, you know, when you enter the word drone into the dictionary, either a UAV, a Predator or a Reaper picture pops up next to it. Well, the next article, malfunctioned drone hits U.S. Navy ship during naval training exercise. The USS Chancellorville was testing its Aegis radar, and a drone was flying at it, pretending it was a cruise missile. Now, 85% of the articles you read about this said that drone was an MQ-9 Reaper, because they were getting confused about the Reaper accident that the New York Air National Guard had by having a training flight end up in Lake Ontario the week before. But the aircraft actually that caused the attack was the BQM-74, otherwise known as the Chucker, which is a Asian pheasant is what it's named after, but the BQM-74 has been around a very long time, and the Navy uses it precisely for gunnery training and as a cruise missile. And what happened was, is this was, they were testing the Aegis radar, and it was supposed to make a 90-degree turn about 2 miles away, skimming the ocean like you would an anti-shipping cruise missile. And unfortunately, it failed and kept going straight and didn't make the turn. So it crashed into the ship, causing two sailors to be injured. And thus we are. But 90% of the articles would have you believe that that missile was a Reaper, which just drove me nuts, Max.
I know. In fact, it confused me as well, because as I was looking into this, I kept flipping back and forth between the articles, and things just were not lining up. Maybe after the press, the mainstream press becomes a little bit more knowledgeable in these areas, they won't make such mistakes. But you mentioned the Reaper that it did go down in Lake Ontario, and they had been trying to locate that, have not yet. But I think they'll keep trying, obviously. But we don't know causes for either of these yet. The USS Chancellorville is back at port, which is in San Diego. They're going to take a look at the damage to the ship and assess that. But we don't know at this point, I don't think, what caused that failure. And we don't know what caused the failure into Lake Ontario.
Yeah, we'll have to follow up that. But so we have a chucker that, it's interesting because one of the BQM 74Es was actually found by a fishing vessel earlier in the year off the coast of Japan. But this week, we actually have a trawler going fishing in the Mediterranean, in the Black Sea. And lo and behold, they rescued or caught a kind of fish called a turna, which is actually named after a crane, so which is owned by the Turkish Armed Forces. You want to go into a little bit more about that, Max?
Yeah, this must have been quite a event for those fishermen when you're pulling up your net and thinking, boy, it feels kind of heavy. Maybe we've captured something or netted something rather large, and it turns out to be this this UAV with a 2.5-meter wingspan. But this is produced by Turkish Aerospace Industries, and this is something it's been used by them since, I believe, 2001, so it's been around for a while. It's a target drone that's used in air defense training. It's got a turboprop engine that it's powered by, but the photos show the fisherman's net with this turna caught up in the net, and I'm sure that it doesn't really help the image of the Turkish aerospace industries at all. But at least the thing has been recovered, I guess.
Well, it is a target drone, just like the Chucker is, and it's designed to be shot at, and right, they're going to go down in the water. I mean, turna is awfully close to tuna and crane, so I guess this is our chicken of the sea version of the episode. But yeah, you can imagine pulling up your net and expecting maybe a shoe because of the weight. And you know what I was really sort of surprised was you don't really see the fisherman holding it up like you would get that normal shot of the trophy.
Yeah, caught so, the big one.
That we caught the big one. So I'm sure the Turkey Air Force is happy to have their drone back. But it's a really nice, lighthearted story to end the episode, because you know this goes so quick, Max.
Oh, it does. But there's always so much to talk about. Just briefly, I wanted to mention that there's a company called Icaros, and they had a webinar this past week where they showed participants their photogrammetric suite of software. And you know, when we talk about applications for drones and aerial mapping and so forth, you know, that's usually accomplished by via a camera of one sort or another, taking images. And what you have to do after that, of course, is put all those images together in a mosaic, sometimes three-dimensionally, so that you can view what it is that you've been mapping. And this company produces some really interesting software that does that. And one thing that I got out of that webinar, David, was that, you know, it's not as simple as it seems to take all these photographs and assemble them into an accurate, dimensionally accurate representation of the terrain that being mapped. So they've got some interesting software, not to plug that, but only to mention that, you know, as we sometimes focus on the hardware involved in these things and the control systems and the operators and the regulations that are to come, there are a lot of other aspects to UAS activity, and this kind of software that helps unmanned vehicles perform some useful task is interesting, and it's a big part of the overall picture. So just wanted to mention that.
And I guess that's a good segue. We have our website up, and if we have anybody out there who might want to sponsor the show, we're going to have our rate sheet up shortly. So should we talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, sure, David. The UAV Digest is a member of what we call the Airplane Geeks family of aviation podcasts and blogs. We've mentioned the other podcasts that David and I are on, Airplane Geeks, but there are some others as well. And you can learn about all of those at airplanegeeks.net. There's also a page in there for this podcast, the UAV Digest, that provides some information about opportunities for your company or your organization to become a sponsor of this podcast. So you can visit the UAV Digest page at airplanegeeks.net.
And we look forward to that, but most importantly, it's getting towards that time of the year and the holidays, and we want to thank all of our listeners so far who've joined us on this ride, and we keep learning a lot, and I guarantee you by next year, both of us will have piloted or owned quadcopters or hexacopters, and we're really enjoying it, and we have had a lot of fun doing this, and I think we're going to have, in 2014, we'll be even more fun. I think we're well on our way, and it's because listeners like you, and you keep writing in. The address is
feedback@theuavdigest.com, and of course the website is theuavdigest.com. You can also follow us on Twitter @UAVDigest, also our Facebook page, UAV Digest. So you've been listening to episode 15 of the UAV Digest.
And again, as always, this is David in Philly.
And Max in Hartford.
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.